army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome back to Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast. This is episode 071, The Devil's Thermostat, Turning Up the Heat on American Civil War. A little bit of housekeeping is in order. This just so happens to be published on Monday, September 22nd, and that will be within 2 days of the inaugural Episode 1 podcast 3 years ago. This is the third anniversary of the Chasing Ghost podcast, along with War Notes, a Conflict podcast, which is a companion to this, so that I could broaden my portfolio of speculation and observation to the conventional aspects of warfare, either contemporaneously in history, which all of my listeners know informs most everything that we do, because if you don't know where you've been, you can't possibly know where you are. And of course, the conflict futurism that we will pontificate on occasionally in levy forecasts. Forecasts, of course, for those of you who are new to my podcast, has an evidentiary bar that's lower than that of predictions. So when you hear me prognosticating on what the future may hold for all of us, I am simply forecasting and not predicting, and could very well be very wrong in the assignations that I make. Over the past week, I had a health scare for me. I had the misfortune of having a heart attack at the age of 53. Now, it just so happens that for the most part, even as a middling officer in the U.S. Army, I was in pretty good condition in the aggregate, especially compared to my non-military contemporaries at the time. I have had a heart rate that since retirement from the U.S. Armed Forces has been between around 55 to 70, mostly low-end 60s. My personal best heart rate at my best aerobic conditioning in the U.S. Armed Forces was at 42, and here I am in what Sinatra would characterize as a little bit past the September of my years, and trying to do my best to head off health difficulties that I may have. Most of my health difficulties are because I lost the genetic lottery when it comes to my heart and such. So there it is. Had a scare. That kind of scare can make you reassess, take a knee, drink water, and do things to change the trajectory of the remainder of your life until you assume room temperature. One of the things that I did in the past week is that I've always been a casual drinker, haven't drank too much, but I called the ball, and from this point onward, I will no longer drink alcohol. For the first 10 years of my marriage, I did that very thing just to test myself, because there is an addiction spectrum in my family to which, when I'm abstemious, I find that that is the very best way to avoid those kind of things. For instance, I have never, do not, and will never play video games, because I know who I am and what would happen and how that would waste a tremendous amount of time. In other news, I completed my course, my first course for the Scott Horton Academy. This inaugural course is about the stalemate and defeat of American Armed Forces, and I would say by extension, Allied and Coalition Armed Forces in the West since 1945, and fast forwarding 80 years to this year, 2025. And what informs that? What are the historical characterizations? What are the frameworks? Why did it happen? What made this multi-trillion dollar enterprise in the West fail ever so miserably in everything it tried to do in war? So When that course is published, I'll be sure to let you know and hope that you give it a gander. On to the episode. Charlie Kirk was murdered / assassinated this month, September 2025. Most likely, the perpetrator was left of center, a collectivist, a government supremacist, possibly even a communist. More than likely, and all of this will come out in the court documentation and such, it will turn out that this person was also maybe an acolyte of the more exotic, arcane, and odd woke franchises that have been out there with the snow-coned, pierced, and tattooed college-educated folks who would join organizations like Antifa and things like that. Now, I suspect it was not a person, right of center, who conducted this murder of Charlie Kirk in a very public fashion. But nonetheless, what this particular murder has done is stir the pot again, that witch's brew, that big fat cauldron of speculation on civil war in America. Non-kinetic, kinetic. Is it a cold civil war? Is it a hot civil war? Will it become hot? Only the future will tell, but it doesn't mean that members of my audience or those who don't listen to this podcast and members of my audience, you know, discuss what we talk about here. The talk of civil war in America has burbled to the surface in a fashion I think that even exceeds the rage days of the late 60s and early 1970s in America, when bombings and street violence and things like that, not criminal, but street political violence, were daily occurrences in big cities across America. Brian Burroughs covers this in his extraordinary book, Days of Rage. Highly recommend it. So here we are. It's going on half a century later, and I would say that at this time, we are at a point in which the brewing, the temperature, using the doomsday clock that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists likes to talk about with nuclear war possibilities that they've been doing for decades and generations themselves, we have a doomsday clock here. Would I assess that the doomsday clock is closer now to midnight, midnight being D-Day, midnight being the Day of Wrath, sorry, William Fortune, D-Day being that day when stuff kicks off. So this is in the news, and it's quite a complex subject with many variances and permutations that we're going to entertain in today's episode. The first thing I want to do, for those of you who are new to this podcast, welcome, and thanks for coming aboard. And it helps to reinforce this for those who are persistent and regular listeners of this podcast, is that all empires die. The list of empires that have died in history go on and on. The Roman Empire is no more. The British Empire died in 1947 and 1948. The Mongol Empire is no more. The Persian Empire is no more. The Akkadian Empire, the earliest known empire, the Ottomans, dead. The Russians, dead. Characteristically, it is a large political entity or territory ruled by a single sovereign authority, such as an emperor or queen, and controls diverse peoples and lands beyond its original borders through conquest or other means of control. This doesn't mean that all empires are dead, because America is an empire and has been an empire, arguably since the first time in the 1880s when it took on the Hawaiian Islands and annexed them as a U.S. territory, and the United States hasn't slowed down since. It is unpopular to characterize America or the United States as an empire, but it certainly is. And remember, everything empires do abroad, it always comes home. Which leads us to another question in this explanatory framework. So if empires die and empires aren't forever, because none of them are, what happens that leads to their denouement and their demise and them turning to dust? Well, as with all subjects of historical inquiry. This happens to be something that is informed by many proximate causes and root causes. One of the root causes that I would judge from this is that eternal human notion of tribe, of clan, of blood, of habitual affiliation and neighborhood, as it were, being near each other. I have said before on this podcast, having spent 2 years in Afghanistan, that Afghanistan outside of Kabul was not a construct that anybody recognized outside of what we look at on a map as Afghanistan, because clan and blood and generational contiguous relationships determined what the fealty was of the people there. And this construct of Afghanistan is an illusion outside of Kabul, because in Kabul, America and its allies and coalition members came in with buckets of cash, pallets of cash, tossed it around, played their color revolutions, and put in power those people who would bend to the will of the United States and its allies to make the national security situation there neutral or beneficial to the West. That didn't turn out the way they thought it would, but it rarely does turn out the way that they thought it would. Here's what we know as a fact of life when it comes to warfare, is that regional conflict complexes, which I have discussed before, but I'll give you a thumbnail sketch now, means that when intrastate or interstate warfare takes place, the distinction between the former and the latter is that the latter is what takes place between warring nation states with established borders, and interstate would be what one in the West would characterize as guerrilla insurgencies and the kind of unrest within a country's borders proper that causes it to fracture. This can fracture into a civil war, and a civil war generally has two characteristics. One of those characteristics is a civil war in which there is a breakaway republic or entity, a political entity in this case, that wishes to divorce itself entirely from the central government and wants to establish their own territory that is independent, whether contiguous or non-contiguous, of the ruling authorities in this either imperial framework or non-imperial framework with smaller states. The other civil war is what we have characteristically seen, for instance, in the English-speaking world, in the West, and in Europe, where the central government authority, through Machiavellian intrigue or actual warfare, seeks to replace that central government with a government of their own. No secession, no nullification, no balkanization, no separation, or even entertaining the possibility of breaking apart and bifurcating or trifurcating or whatever the case may be. It's not going to happen, and the reason it won't happen is because there is an ambition on this one side that is contesting central government power on whether it is to be replaced or not. And when this witch's brew of conflict, whether it is the cold civil war that America has suffered for the past few decades, if not generations, between competing parties and visions for what they want the central government to do in relation to the states, which Lincoln put on notice in 1860 and put to the test through 1865, that the states would no longer be, in America, independent entities that had their own resident nullification authorities, and they weren't mere suzerain citizens of the United States central government, because prior to 1860, the common argo was, these United States are. Well, after 1865, it was the United States is. And as I have discussed earlier in a slight departure here, language is everything. And when you unconsciously make the assumption that the United States is instead of these United States are, these four simple words transform entirely how that chain of authority, allegiance, and obedience works. And one thing, by the way, most folks who are involved in a civil war understand is that questioning authority is one thing, and it's romantic, and it can be done, and it may not even lead to war. Now, questioning obedience, that would be the central question that is the animating factor for war. Now, finally, before we get to the temperature of Civil War, Cold War, and what's going on in America, one final thing we have to tackle here in our explanatory framework, and that would be regional conflict complexes. I'm certainly not the author of this or the inventor of this idea, and I've talked about this in previous episodes, but it does present what I think is a very compelling notion on why these things happen and why they tend to lose control over how the violence occurs after the first shots are fired in respective civil wars. The Civil War of 1860 to 65 was the second civil war in American society because, technically speaking, April 19th, 1775, through the Paris Peace Accords in 1783, where the divorce from London for the Atlantic seaboard and the Americans there was finalized and approved. When that war took place, there are so many reasons why. I would urge all of you, if you get the opportunity, to dig into my episode catalog where I take care of some of these in a far more expansive fashion. And also, I even devote one of my podcast episodes to the 24 to 48 hours on April 19th, 1775 with Lexington and Concord, which inaugurated that first divorce from London, that civil war, because it was a civil war. It was a civil war because prior to 1775, in the French and Indian Wars, the first 18 to 24 months of that particular imbroglio on the North American continent between the Spanish, between the French, and between the British, which ended with British supremacy in both Canada in America at the time, the French and the Spanish empires for the 10-year interregnum between the conclusion of the French and Indian Wars and the start of the Civil War in England between the Americans on the Atlantic seaboard and the UK, the Spanish and French had plotted a vengeance that they would make existential, because if it weren't for the Spanish and the French, more so the French, but thank you anyway, Spain, Washington, and all of the other martial and political luminaries during that entire time would not have materially succeeded in defeating the British, because the British, essentially, in the French and Indian Wars from 1754 to 1763 on the North American continent, soundly defeated them, but nonetheless, Spanish and French, unbowed, but ready to rock again over 10 years later. You will note that, by the way, in taxonomy, the French and Indian War, from a historiographical perspective, is called that war. You will note that I do not use that argo. I call it the French and Indian Wars, and the reason that I do that is I use this as a preamble to explain to you what regional conflict complexes look like in real life. And that's because every time there is a major war on planet Earth, no matter where it is, it breathes oxygen into the cold, warming, or maybe even rather heated ashes of any conflicts that had taken place beforehand and breathes new life into them. When World War I happened, we can thank Woodrow Wilson, by the way, for World War II. He is patient zero because of what he did in World War I with American forces entering the war against Germany and the Central Powers. That led to World War II. That led to this entire intercontinental imbroglio from 1914 to 1945, in which the embers were oxygenated to such an extent planet-wide because of the eradication of colonialism as the quaint Victorian concept that it was in the 19th century and a little bit into the 20th century, and also with the victory of the USSR and the Chinese and the Communist project in World War II, all of a sudden you had two tensions growing in these regional conflict complexes planet-wide. Number one was the race for the erasure of all European and maybe some non-European colonial holdings, even though there weren't that many of them. This would be focused in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, which is Kampuchea now, Burma, which is now Myanmar, and other countries, and Africa. And it proved to be a very bloody affair throughout all of these campaigns. As a matter of fact, it was the very British campaigns in Africa after World War II to hold on to some of their colonial breadcrumbs in Africa that inspired me to start this Chasing Ghosts podcast in the first place. Thank you, Great Britain. So remember, I like to discuss these complex subjects and break them out into their component parts. So you've stayed with me so far. So now what we're going to visit is a book by a fellow that I admire greatly. Don't agree with everything, but I admire greatly his theoretical framing of how these conflicts occur. He wrote a book called Non-State Warfare, The Military Methods of Guerrillas, Warlords, and Militias. Stephen Biddle, shout out to you, Stephen. This is an extraordinary work. You will note that in a past episode I did on Civil War, I also gave kudos to Dr. David Betz, B-E-T-Z, who is a UK irregular warfare scholar and observer who has done extraordinary work in detailing how incipient and emerging civil wars are occurring, even in the United Kingdom itself, which, according to Dr. Betz, would quickly expand to other revolutions that would be inspired by what could happen on the ground in the United Kingdom in the next 5 years, and to sort of misappropriate Churchill, set Europe ablaze. Now, stay with me here. In this book, which I recommend you buy, it'll be in the show notes, in the chapter, A Spectrum Between Fabian and Napoleonic Extrema. I love that word. In fact, I'm quoting here, in fact, there are very few, if any, features of modern warfare that are literally or even mostly unique to non-state actors as opposed to state armies. Yet, this is not to say that state and non-state military methods are identical. There are important distinctions, but these are interpenetrated matters of degrees rather than kind, and the common language of conventional and guerrilla or irregular is unhelpful as a vehicle for explaining them. For too many observers, these terms connote discrete, mutually exclusive alternatives. Given this, I instead frame variants in state and non-state military methods on a continuum spectrum between rarely seen extremes that I will describe as Fabian and Napoleonic. These endpoints represent abstract archetypes, pure versions of the institution reflected in the terms guerrilla and conventional, without the overlapping shared traits that actual modern militaries display. As such, they will rarely, if ever, be observed in modern combat. Their role is instead to enable real militaries to be coded in terms of their relative distance from these two abstract extrema. So the Fabian architect is named for the Roman dictator and general Quintus Fabius Maximus Varicosus, 280 BC to 203 BC, whose strategy of avoiding battle with the superior Carthaginian army of Hannibal Barca focused on raids and harassment against the Carthaginians' extended lines of communication to exhaust them rather than on destroying them. The term Fabian strategy has subsequently become associated with methods of delay and protraction without decisive battle. I use it here to signify a pure version of the intuition behind modern guerrilla war. As such, I define it as an absolute unwillingness to accept exposure or to defend ground via decisive engagement at any point in the theater. Dispersed operations with no local concentrations, in excess of the theater-wide combatant density, exclusive reliance on coercion, insistence on concealment obtained via intermingling with the civilian population, and rejection of heavy weapons, even when available, in favor of light arms and equipment more suitable to concealment among the population and a spatially undifferentiated uniform distribution of forces across the theater without an identifiable front or rear, end of quote. I know this is a mouthful, and I know that conceptually, sometimes when I'm communicating this kind of thing, not from a book, but reading a book to you, that it could be a difficult thing to apprehend. But what I want to get at here, and what I think Biddle really does extraordinarily well, is he is drawing that very peculiar distinction between not standing one's ground. We were just talking about the French and Indian Wars. And one thing that characterized the French and Indian Wars, and then the Southern conflicts that would occur on the Atlantic seaboard during that first Civil War between London and the Americans, was this kind of thing where there wasn't a stand to and fight, harassment, raids, and then dissolving into the woodline, as it were, whenever a strong, contestable, conventional military force would show up, they would dissolve. Now, one can say when during this fight on the Atlantic seaboard, I would say this was learned from the Aboriginal Americans at the time and emulated by the Europeans who arrived in country at the time. That would be the 16th century through, of course, all the centuries afterwards. And I want to point out something else that's very interesting when it comes to learning from Aboriginal Americans and the particularly American character in war that was developed, especially which accelerated after the 18th century, which is that with a frontier like America, individual combat, single combat, minutemen, that term for those who kept their kit available for at any time when they would have to grab their rifle, grab their possibles bags, grab their ammunition and their kit, and rush out the door to meet at muster with their fellow militia members and go to war in the fashion that they would find fit, in which they could go to war and survive to fight another day by not being toe-to-toe with conventional forces. You would find again and again, for instance, when you take a look at what happened to the French in Indochina, what happened to the French, coincidentally, in Algeria. They're fighting both of these wars after the conclusion of World War II. And they're fighting one, of course, in Vietnam, French Indochina, and another one in Algeria, which, since the 1830s, had been a part of metropolitan France. There weren't stand-to fights, but they were degrading, decaying, harrying, and really demoralizing the French forces in both of those countries and regions. Biddle has more to say. Quote, "The more one breaks down the actual conduct of war by state and non-state actors, the less autonomous or internally consistent either nominal category thus appears. In fact, the typical categorical distinctions are misleading in important respects. There is nothing intrinsic to state status in the conduct of war. There is great variance in the actual military behavior of both state and non-state actors, and there is important and growing overlap in the methods of nominally conventional and nominally guerrilla warfare. The most interesting and important part of the spectrum is not the conceptually pure extrema, rather it is the conceptually intermingled middle. And the most important developments in military behavior over the last century of warfare have been a series of variations by degree in the behavior of actors whose methods are substantially removed from either simple archetype. To do justice to these developments thus requires us to move beyond the guerrilla warfare stereotype and to treat military behavior as a continuous spectrum between uncommon extrema." End of quote. Now, what I find so revealing in this is that for the longest time, especially for those who have been listening to me since episode one, I've told you that there is no linear characterization to the various generations of warfare from first through fifth. So the first four generations of warfare, you can go back to several episodes to see what that's about. I do discuss that in detail. But when it comes to generations of warfare, it is the fourth generation of warfare, unlike the first, second, and third, that is the one that characterizes itself as irregular warfare. That has been my entire modus operandi, I'd say, universally in all of these episodes that I've done in Chasing Ghosts is to prove out that not only can guerrilla warfare operate independently, it can operate in concert, whether consciously or unconsciously, with conventional warfare operators. It can be manipulated in a fashion by political actors. For instance, why would Benjamin Netanyahu from 2016 until 2020 provide funding and materiel to Hamas during that time, whose charter was to destroy the very nation that was giving it money under the table? He was doing that so that he could put the Palestinian Authority itself on its back foot because it would have competing political elements within its respective society in Gaza so that they would squabble among themselves instead of squabbling or go to war with Israel. This is as old as time and political maneuvers that have been going on for millennia. Biddle makes the comprehensive argument, as Douglas Porch does in his counterinsurgency book, that you can have one military force, but you can't have two. You can have a military force that is especially good at counter-guerrilla counterinsurgency. And of course, we know that the West, America in particular, can't do counterinsurgency. I would say that, as a matter of fact, by policy and practical application, it's impossible the way it's presently set up. And the other thing is, can a force be ready for conventional war in concert with having these capabilities against COIN? For me, it's a big categorical no. You cannot have the way the American institutions are structured today, ineffective special operations forces or unconventional warfare force or any of those irregular warfare rubrics that we employ to describe what that warfare looks like. America doesn't do it well at all, and there is no European ally in the West who does it well at all. America does do exquisite platforms well, but that makes it fit for purpose for peer combat in the 20th century, but makes it not fit for purpose in the 21st century. So with this entire preamble to the question in the title of this podcast, where we are examining incipient civil war on the U.S. continent. This could also be not only in CONUS, but in Alaska, Hawaii, and territories like Puerto Rico and such. We're examining, well, where are we now? I would tell you that I would characterize since the 1970s, arguably since the end of World War II, when communism became legitimized as a political construct, not only planet-wide, but in various parts of the American body politic, to include especially the media and universities, where communism is almost a government supremacist ideology of choice throughout all these institutions, and it appears, especially with the revelations from USAID, that not only has it been funded abroad, but influence campaigns to do that very thing and strategic shaping campaigns to make communism fuzzy and comfortable has been a modus operandi for decades, if not generations. So here's my framing. Is America in the incipient phases of a kinetic civil war? Very possibly. Has America been in a cold civil war, which involves the things that I just elucidated, along with domestic color revolutions, voting and tampering with said vote? If one takes a look at balloting identification requirements planet-wide, America is one of the few countries on Earth that doesn't require it in some of its states, predictably swing states dominated by a party, in this case, the Democrat Party, which, when it comes to voter irregularity and lack of integrity, has been off the charts since electronic balloting and mail-in balloting has come into the fore. A civil war has many fathers, and a civil war has many components that make it tick and operate the way it does. Now, when I suggest to you the following three critical components of a civil war, please don't say that that is the be-all and end-all and there are no other proximate or maybe root causative vectors that will contribute to this. But burn these into your brain, and that would be, number one, grievances, real or perceived. Number two, legitimacy of the campaign undertaken by the guerrillas themselves, whether they are an individual organization or they have allied themselves, like so many civil wars, from the Spanish Civil War all the way back in time to ones that we see contemporaneously, with others who seem to have the same objective in mind. And then narrative. Narrative is this curious framing where the savvy and smart guerrilla set, the insurgent, is going to make sure that every time they conduct an IED bombing, every time they conduct any kind of, let's say, conduct to address or incentivize voting irregularities, they always have a videographer in tow. Because whatever the language, and I find that when it comes to Arabic narratives, they have, in Islamic narratives, they are geniuses when it comes to the videography. They take it back to the cutting room, the editing room. They add in the music. They add in all of the hypnotizing vibes from that particular religion when it comes to animating their young men, such as the very primal but effective words, Allahu Akbar, which is repeated again and again. And how effective this is in making these men, in this case, the Islamist fighters, so effective in what they do and so instrumental in why they do what they do, where you have cadres of dozens, hundreds, thousands of young men who are willing to die for their cause without question. As a matter of fact, not simply dying for their cause without question, as countless young men have done in history, but to do so willingly as human weapons. These kind of things outside of the Islamic religious sphere have occurred in a somewhat secular fashion, for instance, when one looks at the Divine Wind, the kamikaze suicide bombings that started to take place in the desperate last years in 1944 and 1945 with the Imperial Japanese, where they could choose people, but they got mostly volunteers to willfully fly an aircraft, for instance, into a ship. So where are we today? What's the temperature in the room here in the United States? There are two distinct Civil War vibes that are running throughout America today. Number one would be this classic competing ideology between the wings of the Uniparty, the Republicans and the Democrats. Some of it is kabuki, maybe a lot of it is kabuki, and there's a lot going on behind the scenes, which through strategic misalignment, misinformation, disinformation, what the Russians would call maskarovka and desinformatsia, the public is always chasing down stuff that doesn't really lead to what I prefer to make Occam's razor, which is the most simple explanation. So let's handle each one in turn. We'll start with this. I have found that it's very liberating not to be a member of either political party or take part in political campaigning, voting, that kind of thing. And it gives me, to a certain extent, a slightly more objective, where I am not plagued by what Peter Boghossian would characterize as side bias, which is one of the most difficult fallacies and bias filters to overcome with your brain pan and come to a decision or a framing intellectually of what exactly is going on. What is the single most accurate picture here? So here's what we do know, and these are facts that are undisputed. The Democrats want power and the Republicans want power. That power comes from not only the awful office, that would be OFFAL, the awful office, if you want to spell it AWFUL, please do so. Or it comes from the Senate, or it comes from the House of Representatives, or it comes from the judiciary, or it comes from that vast deep state apparatus of the unelected officials, the 8,800 some odd senior executive service personnel who from administration to administration with the kabuki dance of who's going to be in the awful office at any time. Well, it is those and the agencies, the permanent state, the deep state, whatever you want to assign it as, they're the ones who run the country and they're the ones who take the determination on where the power is and where the power of the purse, the taxing power, the debt creation power, where they spend their money. A few moments ago, I had mentioned the U.S. Agency for International Development, which for the longest time was used by the CIA and other intelligence organizations throughout United States history as a cutout to avoid presidential findings. A presidential finding is that when a clandestine or covert action is taken by, in this case, most likely the CIA, but it could be some of the smaller intelligence organizations. When that is done, the president has to approve of that covert or clandestine action. Most of these are color revolution activities. Some of them are assassination activities, despite the prohibitions imposed by the Congress in the 1975 church hearings. We all know with a wink and a nod that when the 21st century came on and September 11th occurred and America found itself embroiled in conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, the Horn of Africa, Yemen, and all these other places, no one can say with a straight face that targeted assassination was taken off of the deck as an option because of what we've seen happening with drone warfare, for instance. There is no doubt in my mind, and one doesn't have to be aligned with a particular party, nor am I saying that one of the parties is better than the other, but there are things that are happening, for instance, with Antifa, BLM, and other associated terrorist organizations that are fomenting or incentivizing or shaping the landscape, as it were, for kinetic operations to take place. We began this episode with talking about the Charlie Kirk assassination very briefly on the campus in Utah. And that most certainly is terrorism. The best definition of terrorism that I've ever heard is from Caleb Carr, the military historian, and he said that terrorism is politically motivated violence against non-combatants. And I think that that pretty much sums it up very well, and that's certainly what we're seeing here. So, if it turns out in future forensic investigations, once whoever is responsible in the U.S. government, whether that is the FBI or the U.S. Treasury, FinCEN, or whatever organization finally hires the right guys, dozens, hundreds of them, to sit down with all the forensic cell records that are available now. And by the way, in this 21st century, when it comes to getting to the bottom of who the movers and shakers are, that would be the trigger men, the bomb makers, the financiers, the folks who run the safe houses, the folks who run the rat lines, the folks who run the entire guerrilla infrastructure. Because of cell phones and because of a lack of discipline for human beings under the age of 30, there is a bonanza of information that is available to do something that is very important in tracking down and ameliorating these organizations. Picture a very large whiteboard on a very large wall, and you have all of the cell phone records in front of you of the folks that you have targeted. Then you start to put together institutional and organizational association matrices of who talks to who the cell cutouts are, how that cellular activity works. By the way, I won't trouble you here with it, but in episode 51, I did an episode entitled Cellular Ecology, Guerrilla Organizations, and Grunt Math, where I cover this in excruciating and sometimes boring detail, but it's very important to know this and to know how it works, because it is the association matrices that allow you to track down who it is who is responsible for this, and you can either cut the head or the heads off of the Hydra and work your way down through cellular cutouts and ameliorate and eliminate the threat altogether. I have often told colleagues that I so wish the day after September 11th that sobriety and a lack of emotional impulse had informed our reaction to what Al-Qaeda had done. Bring in dozens or hundreds of personnel who had been involved in fighting organized crime. They would take these aforementioned association matrices and affiliation matrices and all of these big trees that they could put together of who is connected to who, and then they could have put together in a six-month period of time a very sophisticated tree of exactly who was responsible for carrying out the act, providing the logistics and material for the act, financing it, planning it, all of it, and then surgically strike those and provide whatever kind of cautionary tale or warning to other terrorist organizations planet-wide by eliminating the entire Al-Qaeda threat. But of course, we know that is not what happened. And then we have what happens in civil wars in a very common fashion. You found this during the Spanish Civil War, where various, what they called back at the time, anarchist and communist factions, the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea, would get together for common cause, but there would be factions and risks in there that would over time boil over and turn into factional infighting and intersectional cannibalism that would consume the effectiveness of these organizations and render them moot in being able to achieve militarily at the time during the Spanish Civil War what they needed to do. It didn't help the Spanish communist and anarchist and all the government supremacists who were involved in that, for instance, exhuming the bodies, because they were so anti-religious and anti-Catholic, exhuming the bodies of nuns and priests and taking these skeletal remains and propping them up against a wall to make light of them. That's the kind of informational and narrative shaping that always backfires. You see examples, not kinetically, of some of this today with the viscerally anti-human and dehumanizing reactions of members of the left and their characterization of their glee and schadenfreude at the murder of Charlie Kirk and making light of what that means and what it meant for his family to be there and such. These are things that don't help guerrilla organizations out at all. So we're going to check the box on political violence for civil war. And I would tell you that the temperature is rising and I don't see when it's going to stop. Now we're going to consider something that I started in episode 37 with my Storming America series and did, I think, 6 episodes. You can find out by going to episode 37, all the other episodes that I've done on this very thing, which in toto means that Islamist cells, for the pleasure of having easy grunt math, would be 1,000 cells of 10 men each who would rise up on a Tuesday morning, and they would, through synchronization and contemporaneous action, foment mayhem through kidnapping, raping, killing, maiming, disrupting, neutralizing across the country in urban and non-urban areas. And of course, it would probably kill tens of thousands of Americans and maim and kill hundreds, if not millions, of Americans. Again, go back to those episodes, and I don't have to repeat myself on here. On the Sean Ryan Show in December, Sarah Adams, a former CIA person, intelligence operative or analyst, whatever she may be, maybe we'll never know, she came out and she said, you know, there's a possibility of Islamic terrorism on American soil. Of course, I had talked about that in April of that very same year when she appeared on the show in 2024. Now, there is a personage by the name of Laura Loomer. I am not saying that I follow her or anything or give her any credence, but she said something very interesting because I do like Joe Kent, who is in charge of the National Counterterrorism Center. He's an operator, apparently a shooter, and he's a pretty savvy guy when it comes to assessing terrorist and guerrilla threats. Look him up. I think you'll find his curricula vitae very interesting. Quote, sources tell me tonight that the NCTC has officially determined that Islamic terrorists affiliated with Al-Qaeda have infiltrated U.S. soil and are actively planning a series of coordinated Islamic terror attacks. This marks the first time federal counterterrorism officials have openly acknowledged the immediacy of such threats, signaling a potential escalation in domestic jihadist activity not seen since the height of ISIS-inspired plots in the mid-2010s. According to the NCTC's latest assessment, shared in a classified briefing to congressional leaders and leaked today, Al-Qaeda cells, emboldened by the group's resurgence in Afghanistan and the North and Central Africa, have embedded themselves across major urban centers in the U.S. This has been confirmed, intercepted communications, financial tracking, and human intelligence. Sources tell me this is a sophisticated operation aimed at maximizing casualties and chaos. My sources tell me the attack strategy by Al-Qaeda is designed to sow confusion and cripple emergency response. These terrorists have been purchasing large quantities of police and first responder uniforms from surplus outlets and online vendors in at least five states. These acquisitions, traced through bulk credit card anomalies and CCTV footage, suggest a plan to impersonate law enforcement during the assaults, allowing attackers to blend in, direct panicked crowds, or even execute secondary strikes on fleeing victims. My sources tell me the Al-Qaeda terror attack plans in the U.S. are focused on hospitals and medical facilities. NCTC even has evidence that these terrorists are scoping emergency rooms, trauma centers, and triage points in cities like New York, L.A., Chicago, Houston, and Miami. The intent appears clear: disrupt healthcare infrastructure to prevent treatment of the wounded, effectively creating a second wave of fatalities through denial of care. In the event of an attack, civilians could face a nightmare scenario where friends and foe are indistinguishable, with medics overwhelmed and no safe haven for the injured. The potential for hundreds, if not thousands, of additional deaths in the chaos is described by one DHS source as, quote, horrific beyond comprehension. The plot scale points to simultaneous strikes across multiple cities, echoing Al-Qaeda's historical ambitions for mass casualty operations, end of quote. So, interesting. And as a matter of fact, I will place in the show notes the Counterterrorism Digest report, which is 5 pages long, that talks about this. Okay, so I hate to say I told you so, but they did. I told you so back in April 2024 that this very thing would happen. I was forecasting at the time. I'm certainly not predicting, as I told you earlier in this episode, but there is no doubt in my mind that any time, anywhere within CONUS, that you're going to wake up one morning and you're going to discover that this is happening. Of note, listeners have reached out to me and said, well, what can we do at the atomistic, at the microscopic level? How can I protect friends, family, and those kind of things? Episodes 49 and 50, Storming America, TTP, to make you free, parts 1 and 2. I went over that in detail. What you can do at your local, familial, and friend network level to keep yourself safe. But there's no guarantees there. There's no assurances that you won't be one of the casualties when this clacks off. But if you employ Jeff Cooper's color code, and you remain not in condition white, but in a condition in which your head is on a swivel and you're always looking around and you're always taking advantage of what old Remus used to tell us, always avoid crowds. So we look at all of this, and the other wrinkle is this, and this isn't covered in the 5-page report. And that's what's going to happen if, because of human trafficking and drugs and cartel involvement north to south, east to west, and CONUS with very sophisticated warehousing, logistics enterprises, coverage of arterials, transportation networks. These cells could not have possibly gotten here in situ in the anonymous fashion that apparently they are without the help of the cartels, in my estimation. So that being the case, we see here where two disparate elements, Islamist terror cells, and drug and human trafficking cartels, who normally wouldn't have an intersection unless it benefited both of them, there is a third leg to this particular triad, and that is that we presently have Antifa, BLM, and other left-wing terror organizations on United States soil that hearken and are very nostalgic. As a matter of fact, one can be morbidly reminiscent of what happened, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, with the rage days in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, where bombings and politically motivated shootings were a daily and weekly occurrence in large cities across America. Well, maybe one could take a trip down memory lane and find out, well, how was it dealt with then by law enforcement, intelligence agencies, and those kind of things? That is fodder for another episode in the future. But the point I want to convey here is that all these disaffected political elements, including militant and very apparently armed elements in our society who embrace the anti-human creeds of the left in communism, democratic socialism, in all the isms that are simply under the rubric of government supremacism, they are simply under the rubric of collectivism because they don't prize individualism. Will they be in conscious league with the Islamic terror cells, or will smaller elements of what I just described be in casual contact with the Islamist and such, so that when this event clacks off on that Tuesday or Wednesday morning, and all of a sudden you find shopping malls, highway arterials, K through 12 schools and such hit, will these left-wing elements in the United States find a marriage of convenience in which they assist them by clogging up 911 lines, providing safe houses, providing arms? Whatever the case may be, all of us have to look at this as a distinct possibility. You will note I said K through 12 schools, universities won't be hit, because the Islamist terror cells know that that is the largest source of auxiliary and material support they will get in the United States, apart from the cartels. So I am going to unashamedly borrow that clock from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, where once the clock clicks on midnight, that's D-Day, that's the time in which a huge nuclear conflagration consumes the Earth and renders most human life dead and buried. So where are we at? Civil war in America. Kinetic civil war, not the cold civil war that I described earlier, because one can say that politics to a certain extent is always a cold civil war, whether we like it or not. I'm talking here kinetic civil war, whether it is one that is operationally and strategically guided from the top, or tactically where you have these 10,000 members of 1,000 10-man cells, in this case an Islamic-flavored cellular structure, where they are set off as malevolent toy soldiers who don't have to come back, don't have to be directed, because their only aim is to go out and kill, maim, rape, sabotage, neutralize, and pretty much be men of mayhem on American civilization. As I mentioned, that can happen at any time. So let me do this. I'm going to characterize it in this fashion because we all need a baseline for how we measure this. So a baseline measurement for a country that is not embroiled in a hot civil war, we're going to call that one to 10, we're going to call it a 5, because as I mentioned, a cold civil war is always in every society because of competing political parties, not kinetic. But if I look at the subset of kinetic, I'm putting us at 10 minutes to midnight. I'm saying that we are very close to a civil war in America that could be clacked off at any moment, but that the forecast I'll make is this. The way this is going to clack off, if it does, is that Islamic cell rising that I have been describing since April of last year. So with that, I would love to hear your comments and your observations, maybe recommendations for future episodes. Gentlemanly comportment is requested in comms with me. I do thank you for listening and your solicitude. I would ask you, if you listen to this on your favorite podcast vendor, please leave a 4 or 5 star review. And if narrative comments are permitted, I would be obliged and honored if you left those narrative comments. You can follow me on Twitter at WBubert. I have a Substack. You will find the Substack address in the show notes. And again, I urge you all, have your head on a swivel, be prepared for the worst, but live your best life. This is Bill, out.